I've always been interested, like the role of a pastor is an interesting role. There's certainly some teaching and preaching and counseling and components that go into it, but also early on in the process, I was a little bit surprised to kind of begin to work my way through how many other components of the job there are. You know, there's the paperwork and the budgets and the meetings and the this and the that, and I've done everything from driving buses to wrangling sheep, actually. And so in all of that time, you just kind of learn that there's this moving ability to find places where you're going to get involved and where you're going to do the work that is needed to be done. And so in that, a few years ago, I was working at a church staff where we had a children's program that included playing basketball for little kids, like kindergarten through fifth grade basketball. And so in this, we had a whole bunch of teams from the community that sign up, they play basketball, and they recruited people, adults from within the church to coach these kids. Well, if you were coaching a kindergarten team, you didn't really need to know much about basketball. You just hoped that the kids learned how to hold the ball, maybe dribble once or twice before they traveled and ran and shot an air ball and then went back down the other way and did the same thing, right? So that was probably what I would have been equipped to help with. However, when we signed all the teams up and got ready to go, the children's director at our church came to me and said, "Hey, we're short a coach. Would you be willing to coach?" And I said, "Absolutely, that'd be fine. I'd be willing to coach. What grade am I going to coach?" She said, "Well, you coach the oldest kids, the fifth graders." Now, the thing about basketball is when you get to fifth grade, you start to kind of separate out some kids that know how to play and some kids that don't. And you can actually kind of get to the point where they might score like a couple points during the game. You know, they might actually dribble the ball. You might see like a play here and there. And it just so happens there are 4 fifth grade teams that 3 of the teams were coached by guys who had one was a high school basketball coach and was doing it in his spare time for fun. One had played college basketball, and one was a star high school basketball player. So these guys were like legitimate, and then there's me, and I'm a pastor, okay? So we begin by getting all the teams together the first night of practice in the gym, and there's actually 4 different sections of the gym, and each team is supposed to go with their coach and begin to practice. Well, here's what I knew about practice. Well, the objective is to score, and so I gave the kids balls and said, shoot around. That was practice for me. I look over to the other quadrants of the gym, and they're running like drills, like layup lines, showing them what their pivot foot is. I didn't even know what that meant. They're showing them how to shuffle their feet in defense. They're showing them the right way to pass, bounce passes, slide passes, overhand pass. I don't even know. But in this, I'm starting to kind of feel inadequate as a coach going, boy, you know. And not only that, but it's fifth grade, and so it's kind of that stage where most of the parents don't just drop their kids off, but even at practice are standing there watching. And they can tell what's happening here, right? They got 3 coaches, and then they got the guy that was left over, and that's who their kid ended up with. And so they're kind of like, what's going on? And the other thing you ought to know about me is, though I don't know much about basketball, I do know a lot about competing, and I'm pretty competitive, and I'm a pretty sore loser. And it just so happens that I'm an even more sore winner. And so what tended to be the case was in this, I got to feel like I'm pretty inadequate in this whole thing. And so we practiced 2 or 3 times before the first game. And all 3 of the practices are like this. By the 3rd one, I had learned how to fake it a little bit. I was kind of like, yeah, guys, line up here, and then you line up here, and then we'll each shoot. You know, so that way it's in a line. It looks organized, but we're still literally just shooting the ball and hoping that that was making us better. Except that the first game came along, and it just so happened that there was 1 fifth grade kid who couldn't make any of the first 3 practices, but wanted to be in the league and made it just in time for the first game. And it just so happened that that kid got dumped on our team. And it just so happened that they probably should have checked that kid's birth certificate because he was like 6'3 and made every shot. I mean, unbelievable. So we go out in the first game, and there's the coach on the other side, and his team, which is lined up, they come in, they're running like certain drills and sprints at the beginning, and they like are ready to go. And here's my team. I'm like, do you guys got a juice box, or what are we doing here, you know? And we lace up our shoes. the game starts, and Ringer Kid, who I hadn't even seen before, scores 26 points in the first game, and we win by a landslide. Sore loser, even more sore winner, right? So we are walking through the line afterwards, right, to shake hands, and I get to the other coach, and I can tell he's a little frustrated because he's coached hard. He's telling them to, like, set the pick and roll and do this play and do that play. My coaching was, keep at it, guys. Pass it to that kid, right? So in this, we begin to walk through, and I smile, and I shake this guy's hand, and I said, not what you expect, was it? So it was, we knew each other enough that I got away with that comment, but I remember thinking, sometimes what makes us love interactions like that, it's March Madness this time of year going on, some of the reasons that draw us to competitions like that, and that kind of taste for or desire to see the little guy win or the upset or the thing that we wouldn't see coming is because we love, in some ways, the unexpected. We love the story of why someone shouldn't prevail and yet they do. And one thing you see as we're walking through the Gospel of Luke over and over and over again that I've been impressed with is how often it's not the people that you would expect that are finding favor with Jesus, but it's the unexpected. We have now, we're going to spend our fourth week looking at interactions in Luke chapter 7, which is a repeated list of interactions about Jesus connecting with the people that you wouldn't expect him to get along with, and in turn, kind of having some resistance with the people that you would most expect him to get along with. So the religious crowd, the people that seem like they had it all together, tend to find a great deal of resistance and animosity towards Jesus, while the people that you would never expect to get along with Jesus seem to find a great deal of grace and forgiveness and favor. The chapter 7 begins a few weeks ago. We looked at a centurion. That's a Gentile guy. That's a Roman soldier. That's someone who would have been oppressing Jews. And yet, in this, the Bible tells us the only time in a positive light in the entire gospel accounts that Jesus marvels at his faith, that he's impressed by the faith of one who the whole of the Jewish community would have looked at and said, not this guy. This is a Gentile Roman soldier. It continues on and it talks about a widow who loses her son, which in that society would have meant that she was nothing. She was nowhere. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, you think about the book of Ruth and Ruth and Naomi. If you were to lose your husband and your son, that was to put you in a very precarious position. You would have been poor. You would have had no rights. You would have had no value in that society. And she finds the compassion of Jesus and he brings her son back to life. Not only that, but as we continued on, we looked at this interaction with John the Baptist, and where it took us last week was Jesus looking at the Pharisees, the religious leaders, the people of that day that would have been in power when it came to the religious way of life, and calls them like children, that they're just playing games, that they're not really experiencing God at all, but rather that he ought to compare this generation to a generation like children who are in the marketplace playing games. And when they experience John the Baptist and when they experience Jesus the Messiah, they miss it because they don't play the way that they wanted them to play. And so it's in this context that now, this week, we look at another interaction where even more clearly Jesus is going to draw out this, it's not who you'd expect, and sometimes it might be the person you exactly don't expect that's going to find my grace and mercy because they're not going to rely on themselves, whereas this person will. Let me show you how the interaction plays out. Verse 36 of Luke chapter 7. Now, one of the Pharisees was requesting him, Jesus, to dine with him, and he entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. So remember, we just said that what's happened here in verse 30 to 35, is Jesus looks at the Pharisees, the religious leaders, and says, you don't get it. You think you're the ones closest to God, and yet you're the ones missing it the most. You're like children, and you having a case against us, which has now been prevailing for a few chapters and some time in Jesus' ministry. They've kind of come to him questioning him about the Sabbath. They're coming to him questioning about how he handles things. They've questioned him about how he's not fasting. And so in this, they're starting to build this opposition. And so he looks at them and says, you guys are like kids. You're like little children. And the very next verse says, a Pharisee says, come dine with me at my house. Now, we're going to find out later in the scripture here that this was probably a feast, a public Sabbath day kind of feast, where in that culture that meant on certain times you could ask a teacher or somebody prominent to come dine at your table, recline at your table with you, and the community was given an open door. They could come in. It was kind of a dinner and a show, and you could stand along the outer walls and witness how this rabbi was speaking and teaching the people. And so in this, this Pharisee, we find out his name is Simon, invites Jesus to come. This is not a cordial invite. Rather, this is the Pharisees, the religious leaders, hostile to Jesus, trying to build a case against him. They're beginning to look for ways, and what we'll find is that from here until the end of the Gospel of Luke, Luke's going to simply record over and over again the Pharisees finding ways to accuse Jesus, looking for opportunity after opportunity after opportunity where they might say, this is why this guy is wrong. And over and over and over again, Jesus is going to show why he's right. And over and over and over again, the Pharisees are going to acknowledge that and simply move on to what's the next way we can find a way to accuse him. Never being willing to submit to him, never being willing to give up of their own set ways and relinquish their authority and say, you are the Messiah, but rather seeing him do this and going, okay, let's plot again, let's find a way. And so in this, do we find that Simon the Pharisee invites Jesus over to his house, requests to dine at his table. Verse 37 tells us there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster vial of perfume, and standing behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and kept wiping them with the hair of her head and kissing his feet and anointing them with perfume. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. Now, here's what was customary in this culture if you were to have someone over to your house. There were three things that would have indicated good hospitality. Not do or die things, but think about it when we are going over to someone's house. There's some things that you could do that would be hospitable, right? You could offer somebody a drink. You could offer to take their coat. You could give them a seat or kind of show them around the house, tell them maybe where the bathroom is. There's some things that you can do that help someone feel comfortable and welcome and invited. In the same respect, if you were to simply open the door and go, you're here, and go back to your business, you might find that you're being unhospitable. Now, there's times, there's people where that wouldn't matter, right? Like if I come home from work and Whitney doesn't acknowledge my presence and go, hey, would you like a drink of water and can I take your coat? That's a little different, right? Because we're married, we know each other. I'm not saying that that should happen. I just, you know, we'll work on it this week. But so if I'm not here next week, you know why. So what we find is that in this culture, the way that you could do these things, the way that you could care for someone, show them hospitality, was wrapped up in some things that were tied to what it meant to travel around in a desert climate without a lot of water and typically smelling not so great. So you would greet someone with a holy kiss. That was a way to let them know that they were there and distinguished amongst you, that you cared for them. You would give them a holy kiss. I told you, Everett, I'm going to keep you awake. So, that's right. We just get a close-up on how red your face is turning right now. So you would greet them, right? That was stage one. You would, if you were really looking to be helpful in inviting them over for something like dinner, which is what Jesus and this Pharisee are dining over, you would offer to wash their feet. Or you would, if you were someone of prominence, which this Pharisee probably was, you would have a servant in your house take a basin of water and wash your feet, because you don't have socks back then. You wore sandals. You walked. Roads weren't paved. They were dirt roads. It just so happened there are a lot of animals traveling on these roads. And so you were walking through some stuff that you might not want to have near your dinner table, you know what I mean? So in that, you could volunteer to be hospitable by saying, here, let's take off your sandals and have someone wash your feet. It was, in fact, the one who would wash your feet was the most lowly and humble of servants, because again, of what you're washing off somebody's feet, and feet are just gross to begin with. Some of you like it, I don't know. But in that, that's even the example you see of Jesus in John chapter 13 with his disciples. He goes to wash their feet to let them know how much he came to serve them. And so you could care for somebody by giving them a holy kiss. You could care for them by washing their feet. The last thing you could do is, again, desert, travel, no indoor plumbing, running water, showers not readily available, is you could anoint someone's head with oil. It was a way to keep the dirt and the grime down. You know, we have this white hair. There's a different type of hair in Jewish cultures that's curly and thick and matted. And so oil was a way to kind of keep your hair in order at that time. And so it was a courteous and hospitable thing to do this. Well, it just so happens that because of the nature of this interaction, because we're not talking, Jesus, I am really interested in you, come and dine with me, but rather we're talking, Jesus, show up at my house and we'll see what happens. I'm going to quiz you. We'll find some ways where we can find you deficient. That when he arrives, Simon the Pharisee doesn't give him a holy kiss, doesn't offer to wash his feet, and doesn't anoint him with oil. He sits him down at dinner, and presumably they're debating or having some questions. He's looking for a way that he could find a problem in Jesus. And in this time, a woman shows up. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly her nature, just that she's a sinner. And that the Pharisee knew she was a sinner. That meant the nature of her sin was something vile, immoral, and public enough that she would have been recognized in that town. And she sneaks into the room, standing at the back of the room, and they reclined at the table with their feet away from the table, which is how they would have laid at that time to eat. And she begins to wet Jesus' feet with her tears. The verb there in Greek that describes her crying is actually to get wet. It was for a rainstorm. So it's not like I'm sobbing. It is uncontrollable. We don't get whether it's joy or sorrow, but that she is overcome with emotion, that in this she begins to clean his feet with her tears. She lets her hair down, which also in that time would have been socially a taboo, wasn't an okay thing to do, and begins to wipe his feet, clean his feet with her hair. It also tells us that she brings a vial of perfume. This would have been as expensive as anything that she owned. It was reserved in that time for burial. So they didn't embalm people then. What they would do is when they were to bury someone, they would pour a very expensive oil or perfume on them to mask the scent. And so in this was likely her burial plot. This was her cemetery plot type of deal. This was an expensive and important gesture. And so in all of this, the response of the Pharisee to see this interaction sitting across the table from Jesus is what we find in verse 39. He said to himself, not to Jesus, note that, I always love seeing that in Scripture, that Jesus is just reading people's minds and responding to the Pharisees, and they don't seem to catch on what that might mean. But he says, if this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. The main problem, the reoccurring, frequent problem that the Pharisees and the religious people have with Jesus is that he spends a lot of time with blatantly sinful people. Let me say that again. The main problem that the religious people had with Jesus was that he spent time with sinners. That's a really good thing for us. If Jesus didn't spend time with sinners, we'd be in bad shape, wouldn't we, church? You see, just a few verses earlier than that, they wage an accusation against Jesus and say the problem is that he is a drunkard and a sinner because that's the company he keeps. Now, the thing about this that really scares me is that as a church, not just here, but in the United States and all across the world, we kind of see this tendency to believe that being a Christian means that we need to isolate ourselves from all of the sinners in the world. We say things like, well, you don't want to keep company because you don't know how people might perceive that. Or you got to protect your witness by not associating with this person or that person. I remember being taught in high school early on and coming to know Christ, going to a youth group and saying that it was wrong and sinful to go to a movie theater because people might see you there and associate you with some negative company. I had a pastor that I knew that said he wouldn't drink an IBC root beer because it came in a brown bottle, so someone might perceive that he's tipping one back. I drink those in my car to see if one of Reggie's guys will get me. But in that, the temptation, the kind of threatening little line that we have this tendency to walk is that to be a follower of Jesus means you don't associate with the people that don't have their life altogether. The problem with that is it's just clearly not what Jesus did. Now, I'm not saying that the bulk of your time should be spent with a bunch of people who live vile and sinful and God-defacing lifestyles. I'm telling you that the church should be a source of encouragement and that you should find your value and your strength there and you should gather with the saints, but that we should do it so that you can go out into the world to a people who don't know and have a relationship with Christ, proclaiming to them the good news of Jesus, the forgiveness of their sins, and faith in him for salvation, because that's what Jesus did. In fact, in the Gospel of John, Jesus, giving his high priestly prayer, this is Jesus preparing for his death on the cross, is going to pray to God about us and says, I've given them your word, and the world has hated them because they're not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, also I have sent them into the world. That we've been sent not to not associate with the world, but rather to go into the world, to recognize that the people that you wouldn't really expect to submit to the gospel are people that we've been called to go and to care for, to love, to share the gospel with, to be the church, to be the representation of Jesus as he was sent into the world, that we also are sent into the world. And so the thing that scares me the most is that the religious people of that day who wouldn't associate with someone that might be known or have the appearance of being a sinner is the same thing that 2,000 years later I think we see over and over and over again in churches, is that if somebody looks the part, we're okay with it, but if they don't, we have this kind of distrust, this hesitation towards, this lack of willingness to go and be a representative of Christ. In fact, we talked about it in our Sunday school class this morning. We said that's common in the scriptures, and it's common today that our flesh kind of turns us into these people who look at outward appearances and cast out judgments on that based on the way somebody looks or talks. Someone comes in and says the right things and looks the right way and gets greeted with grace and favor. Someone comes in disheveled and unkempt and they get treated as a security threat. We oftentimes fall into this same trap. Oftentimes we, the church, have this tendency to kind of miss where Jesus places his emphasis. Not on the people you'd expect, but on the ones you don't. Here's why. He's going to teach this Pharisee why that might be the case. Verse 40 says, Jesus answered him, which is interesting, he answered him. Remember, he said it to himself. He didn't say it to Jesus. But Jesus replies and says, Simon, I have something to tell you. Simon replies, say it, teacher. Jesus tells him a parable. A moneylender had two debtors. One owned 500 denarii and the other 50. When they were unable to repay, he graciously forgave them both. So which one of them will love him more? Simon answered, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. And he said to him, you have judged correctly. Turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? Now this is where he's going to say what we talked about earlier. I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but since the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she anointed my feet with perfume. For this reason, I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has forgiven little loves little. What I think is interesting, Jesus gives Simon this variation of another parable that he speaks to Peter, that forgiveness is tied to how we view and see the gospel, how we also love God because we recognize our need for forgiveness. But he notes something in this, the same way he does with the other. Both men owe a debt. You see, the reality is there are some in this world who are building up bigger debts than others, that they're living a lifestyle farther from God. But the frustrating part that Jesus sees in these Pharisees is that they believed that they weren't debt holders. They believed that they were okay. They believed that by their merit, their good works, their deeds, they could pay God back. You see, the primary frustration that the Pharisees have with Jesus is that he spends time with these people who are knowingly sinful. But the primary frustration that Jesus has with the Pharisees is that they don't seem to know that they're sinners in need of forgiveness. I think the primary frustration that I see within the church today is a great deal of religion, believing that it's going to make us okay and not recognizing our own sin and need for one to forgive us of our debt. Let me tell you a couple ways that it plays out and then we'll be done. The first is that I think there's this suspicion in the church, and maybe it's even subconscious, we haven't really even dealt with it, and yet what happens is we've kind of fallen into this idea that God needs us. That you read the news and you see the world kind of going into a bad place, and you look at churches, and if you read some statistics, you would say Christianity in the United States is on decline. And so in that, what God really needs is he needs some people to come and cheerlead, right? He needs some people that really are going to represent him well, and that when we do it, we're giving something to God, and so he should be proud of all that we do. The reality is that God doesn't need you. He doesn't need me. Next week we'll look at, in coordination with Palm Sunday, this interaction of Jesus riding into Jerusalem. My very favorite verse in all of the scripture, the people are crying out, Hosanna, blessed is the name of the King, and the religious leaders still kind of looking for a way to accuse Jesus go, that's blasphemy, they're calling you the Messiah, you need to rebuke them. And he says, listen, if I told them to stop, the very stones would cry out. But he doesn't need a cheerleading section. He doesn't need you and I. It's not our merit or our work or the things that we could give as a benefit to the Lord. I think Simon the Pharisee is in this interaction going, Jesus, if you just said earlier that we're like children not playing your game, but the reality is, if you just get alongside us, you'd be on our team. Look at all the things we've got. We're in control of this Jewish religion. We've got all this power and authority. Come over to our side and look at all the things we can offer you. And yet what Jesus is identifying in Simon is that he, like this woman, owes a debt. And he, like this woman, is unable to repay. And that God doesn't need us. Paul writes it this way. He says, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and on earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, and he's not served by human hands as though he needed anything. He himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. David knew it when he wrote the psalm that God said, for every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills I own. I know every bird of the mountains and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all it contains. You see, I think we kind of fall into this trap where we believe that we're really important and that God really depends on us. And the thing that you see about this woman is she recognizes in gratitude that God doesn't need her, that she needs him. That it's not about God needing us, it's about us needing God. It's not about what we can offer to God, it's about what God offers to us. And so in this, Jesus looks at Simon, which I don't know if you picked this up, but a lot of times we read this interaction and think it's about this woman. This woman is just a mere example in the interaction. Jesus is talking the whole time to Simon the Pharisee, evangelizing the whole time to Simon the Pharisee, trying to convince the whole time to wake up for Simon the Pharisee, the religious one, saying, if you just want to rely on your own self-righteousness, you're not going to get it because you owe a debt and you're unable to repay. Look at how this woman approached me versus how you've approached me. If you want to rest on yourself, you can do it, but it's not going to get you very far. A few months ago, in fact, we do this thing coming up to Christmas. I told you about this a little bit. It's our Advent calendars, and so for a month we open up a day on a calendar each day, and inside of it is a piece of candy, and it kind of gets our kids geared up towards Christmas, and kind of use that as a way to teach them about Christ. And so in this, we fill up this calendar with candy, and actually, we don't do it. My in-laws do it for us, and so there's more candy in it, and it's worse for them because they don't have to parent after the sugar is ingested, right? So they're like, just throw as much candy as fits in each day. But in this, there's also some leftover candy, which goes in the cupboard, high in the cupboard, where someone who's 6 foot tall can reach it, but kids can't, right? I don't know why that would be. But in that, there's a great deal of candy that they get each day, and there's always a great deal of candy that I'm eating every day of my life. And so a couple days into the calendar, I kind of tease Claire a little bit and go, man, that's some good candy. That's Dad's favorite kind of candy. So a couple more days go by, and she opens a day of the calendar, and she gets the same piece of candy, a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. Now, it just so happens that in cupboard, said high cupboard, I have a bag filled with Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. Well, about half filled because it was the middle of the month. But in that bag is a bunch of Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. I don't need them. I don't need hers. And yet what she does is she comes to me and she goes, Dad, I want you to have this. I don't need it. Do you see where I'm getting at with our relationship with the independence of God? He doesn't need our offerings. He didn't need Simon's dinner. He doesn't need anything from us. But here's what I did. I said, thank you so much. I gave her a big hug. I was excited about it because I could see the heart of gratitude and love for me that existed in it. And so what I did was I took her over to the cupboard and I opened the tall cupboard and I said, I got something for you too. And I reached in and grabbed a handful of peanut butter cups and I gave them all to her. I said, what do you think about that? You see, when it comes to following God, it's not about him needing your worship. but in gratitude, giving yourself to him. And you just happen to see the way that he returns in blessing and favor and grace and mercy, amazing things in your life. Now here is the temptation of religious people in this, though. The next day, Lydia, our middle child, opens up this calendar of hers and finds a Reese's peanut butter cup in it. Now, day before, she had watched and witnessed this whole interaction. So she comes to me. You know what's happening, right? Look what I got you, Dad. I go, thank you. And I eat it. I put the wrapper in the trash. I go, okay, you ready to go to bed? And she looks at me like maybe she had done something wrong, right? She's trying to do the math in her head. Wait a second. What do you mean, bed? Bed right now? This is how a four-year-old responds to this. Hey, Dad, did you forget something? I said, no, I didn't forget. You see, here's the temptation of religion. What the day before had been an act in gratitude for me, the next day was an act of selfishness for her. She wasn't giving a piece of candy to me. She was depositing a piece of candy for her. Here's how Jesus warns the Pharisees. He says, how can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God? The temptation of religion is to try to do the appearance of righteous things on your own so that you might receive the selfish things you desire. The distinction between this Pharisee and this woman is one desires to worship Jesus. One desires to appeal to the grace and mercy of Jesus. One is overcome by the identity of Jesus, and the other desires to worship self, there to show how put together he is, how much Jesus might need him. And in doing it, desires to make great only himself. But it's not the Pharisee that Jesus' final words go to. It's the woman. Verse 48 says, he said to her, your sins have been forgiven. Those who were reclining at the table with him began to say to themselves, who is this man that even forgives sins? And he says to the woman, verse 50, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. I think you got a choice, church. Maybe you've made the decision and it's a time where you would remember it or be reinvigorated by it. Maybe you've never come to grips with this at all in your life. But I think Jesus describes a choice in this interaction. That you, like this Pharisee, can do a lot of things right. That you, like this Pharisee, can try really hard. That you, like this Pharisee, can rely on yourself. Or that you, like this sinner, we're not even given a name, just a sinner, you can humbly submit it to Jesus. And your faith will give you forgiveness and salvation. Which one are you going to choose?